Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing. If you're still listening, great. Hi, guys.
Hey.
When you're listening to this, if you listen when it comes out, I'm probably in Vietnam.
Yeah, and I'll probably be in the Czech Republic.
Will you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why are you making that sound like I'm lying? Like, I just picked a random country.
So this is like we're going to stick it in the middle of a few weeks off. So I'm going to be telling you the story of Richard Dadd, D-A-D-D. But I've called him by his first name, partly because he's not a bad man, but also I didn't want to be like, and then Dad did this, and then Dad did that. It'd be weird.
When did the daddy thing happen? It definitely wasn't a thing while we were young.
What's that, daddy? No.
Surely everyone finds it creepy, don't they?
Surely. I mean, there's a daddy on Orange is the New Black.
Do your kids say, you've got the older children, do they say like, oh, daddy?
What, to me?
Not to you. Oh, gosh, yeah.
No.
Can I get an A, daddy? No, like to call their boyfriends daddy.
No, I don't think so.
Maybe we're really out of touch. Maybe it's not just like a boyfriend thing. Does it have to be specifically for an older boyfriend? Does it have to be a sugar daddy situation? I thought it was just a daddy, like... Ugh.
I had a handyman the other day who reminded me so much of my dad that I kind of wanted to cry, because it was like my dad was around doing all the jobs that he would probably just do. And when I had to pay him at the end, I was like, the dream is shattered. Because also, I forgot how much my dad used to just get out of breath just like walking up the stairs or something. And this guy was like... And then
I was just staring at the back of his head, like peeping through the banister.
He was in the bathroom.
Even worse, you're creeping on him in the bathroom.
He was in the bathroom fitting a new Lucy, and I was in the room next door curling my hair for Gay Pride. And I could just hear him in there, and it was like my dad was back and doing like little jobs around the house. And then I just wanted to be like, don't make me pay you.
Just spank me till the pain goes away.
Just come and live in my house and do little jobs like my dad would do. So yeah, that was kind of sad.
My dad's alive and he can't do jobs around the house.
Now I've got older kids, they don't call me miss anymore. So I used to get called sir a lot.
Samesies, but weirdly it was like
sir. I was like, why? So right, anyway, Richard Dadd.
Dad
was born on the 1st of August 1817 in Chatham in Kent. His father was a chemist in his work, but he also had quite a big hobby. He enjoyed hunting for fossils, which
nice.
I reckon they probably were quite a lot in Kent, I guess, at that time.
Yeah, if you live by the beach.
Yes.
What else are you going to do?
Fossil area. So when Richard was 7 years old, his mother died. He was one of six siblings, and he went to school at King's School in Rochester. And Richard's father, who's called Robert, met another woman and remarried. But she also died by the time Richard was 14 years old. So it's starting to look a little bit grey and young at this point. But
is he killing them all?
No, it's not the case. Just bad luck.
That's sad.
Richard's father, Robert, stopped...
Bob Dodd.
Bob Dodd, yeah. stopped working as a chemist, but instead he...
He's called Dick Dad.
Oh, yeah. Dick Daddy.
Stop doing the daddy.
You brought it up.
No, but it's giving me the shivers.
So he gave up his job as a chemist and he pursued a career in his dream, which was fossils. So he set up his own museum, but it quickly failed.
Oh my God, he set up a museum. Well done.
Yeah, but it didn't do well. So then,
still.
Yeah, he basically had to leave Kent in shame, I guess, because he moved the family to London.
Well, I suppose if it was just fossils, you need a few, like, two-headed sheep skeletons. You need the curiosities to really get it going.
Yeah, because I mean, it would have taken a long time to get from London to Kent. You've got to have something worth that journey.
Yeah, sew a monkey to a fish. Like, what's that? Like, what's it? Ripley's.
Yeah, I love Ripley's. Richard, with his father and his family, moved to London. So, at school in London, Richard's teachers often commented on how he had an incredible artistic talent. And so he wanted to pursue this further. And his dad, when they got to London, gained a job as a carver and bronze worker. So he was working sort of in an artistic community. He had a lot of colleagues who were artistic.
So his dad's basically just copying him. He's like, yeah. I like fossils. He's like, well, I've got a museum of fossils. I'm really good at drawing. Well, I'm going to be a carver. Like, so, some weird competitive stuff happening here.
Yeah. Well, that'll maybe explain the circumstances later on. So they offered tutoring to Richard because he was this sort of artistic talent, and he just got better and better, and he got a place at the Royal Academy of Arts in London, and he joined this group of artists called The Clique, and I like to think of them as like the original Mean Girls.
Yeah.
But they would like meet, they would go around together. They like, were
on
like...
Wednesdays, we wear cravats.
So the group would get together in the evenings and they'd give each other artistic challenges. And it was sort of stuff like painting scenes from Shakespeare plays. Now, I'm sure it was very sort of...
That sounds like wholesome, nerdy fun.
Well, I'm thinking of it more like Dirty Pictionary. Like, oh, it's Romeo and Juliet at it on the balcony.
Oh, I suppose it depends what scenes they pick. That's true.
I think it was proper.
I thought you meant like the landscape, like, you know, do the wood from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
No, I think it was probably more along your lines. They were supposed to be like pushing each other artistically, I guess. Okay. But in my head, it's just like stick figures boning.
Yeah.
Standard. So in The Clique...
It won't be that. They'll be getting pissed and they'll be sitting around in a little jerk circle going, let's all paint a portrait of each other, and then laughing at them.
They're called The Clique. It makes them sound bitchy as fuck.
Yeah, like just drawing people they know, like, making them look like dicks.
So in The Clique, Richard was the leader. And then John Philip was part, and he later married Richard's sister. And then there were some well-known artists, none of which I'd heard of, but their names were blue on Wikipedia. So there was William Powell Frith, Augustus Egg, which I think I have heard of somewhere because of its ridiculous name.
I'd have remembered if I'd heard of Augustus Egg.
And William Bell Scott. So they were sort of well-known members. I think they were all sort of getting to be well-known in London at this point. Like, these are artistic people. Like, they probably go to certain cafes where, like, all the artists hang out and people are like, these are the ones to watch. So they are growing sort of in status. So Richard began exhibiting his work while he was in London and studying at the Academy. So he included some of his Shakespeare paintings in his exhibits.
Oh, nice.
And they became quite famous. And he began to become quite well known, and he would receive commissions. So, like, he got a commission to illustrate a book. There was a lord who made him, well, didn't make him, but a lord who he painted paintings on the walls of his house. Like, inside, but
yeah,
as a status thing, like, oh, I got this new up-and-coming artist to do a mural for me, that kind of thing. So in July 1842, Sir Thomas Phillips asked Richard to accompany him on an expedition through Europe. So this was a massive opportunity. So basically what they were going to do is travel to Europe, then go to Turkey and then to Syria and to Egypt. And the Victorians at this point were getting a little bit intrigued. There was sort of this obsession with Egypt and the pyramids and the majesty. So it was going to be a free trip for him as an artist, for Richard. But all he would need to do to sort of pay his way was draw the different places that they were going to.
Yeah.
So imagine that. I mean, a round the world tour, organised, sorted, paid for by someone else.
Just do a few doodles on
probably
the way.
A few blowjobs as well. But
that sounds good. I wouldn't say I've become obsessed, but one of the things that I regularly do is like I'll have a place that I put on my weather app and I just constantly refer to how hot it is there. So at the minute, or like about three times a day, I'm just saying to him, guess how hot it is in Aleppo. It's so hot in Aleppo, you know.
Where's Aleppo?
Isn't it? It's in Syria.
Is it?
Because I think after you did the refugee ration challenge, I was thinking about the refugees. It's like, I wonder how hot it is, where they come from. And then it's like 39 degrees there.
Whoa. I only just today I added Vietnam to my weather app. Rain.
Yeah.
The entire week I'm there.
I look at my weather app all the time. I'm like, if we were still in Hamburg, it would be cold now.
Sure, no, 2 days after I get back, I'm like, delete. I do not need to see what it's like in Porto anymore.
No, I just like, I think that's my main conversations with Tom is, if we were still in here, this is what it'd be like.
It stresses me out because sometimes it'll accidentally load up the other place and I'm like, ooh, the weather's looking, oh. Yeah. Like I get all excited and then I realise that I live in England. This trip was not as kind of picturesque as you first thought, because Sir Thomas Phillips, he seemed more of one of those travellers who's like, yeah, I've done this place, move on. He wasn't like luxuriating.
Oh, he's not giving him time to draw it.
Yeah, exactly.
It takes a long time to do his draw. It's not like he's got pictures to reference.
So he filled like a sketchbook of drawings, but he wasn't. Like, I think he thought we'd have a few weeks here, we'd have a few weeks there, we'd go for walks, we'd go and look around. And I think it was very much like, yeah, we've been here, we've spent a night here.
Draw the hotel room, let's fuck off.
Basically, like, my honeymoon was like, every day's a travel day. So Richard, at first, like, they got to Cairo, and he loved Cairo. They spent a bit more time there, because that was the reason they'd gone. And they went on a boat trip up the Nile, and on this boat trip, he began to become delusional and violent, and he started to have these weird beliefs. So these delusions...
That just sounds like week three of any group holiday.
I mean, at this point, it's been, I think, 8 months or so with this one guy.
Yeah, it always happens if you go on a long holiday with one person. You're going to get to the delusion week.
Yeah. So he believed that everything was being controlled.
I did see a boat tour for €20. I did.
I think we only fell out twice in Florida. I think we did all right.
Yeah, I think we did okay.
So, like, he believed that things were being controlled by an Egyptian god. And his fellow travellers, I think they thought he had heat stroke at first. But this carried on and carried on. He became really fixated on religion and the devil. And he was convinced he'd seen the devil. And he said that she looked like... Well, the devil was an old English lady in a lavender dress. Which I
Maggie
think is
Smith.
Accurate. So he'd also tried to attack the Pope when they'd been in Rome as well on the way back.
So it wasn't like a brief period. Like he...
This was ongoing. Like they were, let's get home, but... Everywhere they stayed, he's these delusions. He tried to attack
Ra
the
condemns
Pope.
You to the Pope.
Because they're quite well known as well. He's with this like sir or lord sir. So, I mean, they're going to fancy places and then he's just sort of on a psychotic break while he's there. So when they returned to England from this, it was after a year now. So they'd had a year long trip. It's the next year. He's still hearing voices and he's still obsessed with the devil. And he moves back to his house in London, but he's unable to look after himself. So he starts living off boiled eggs and ale, which I worked with a history teacher that was, I mean, he bought the pre-boiled eggs. It wasn't even boiling his own old
eggs. That's terrible. It's like you're getting constipated from the eggs and then you're getting that alcohol shits from the beer. That is not a fun digestive system.
No. And it's likely that there was some sort of genetic link here as well, because Richard's brother George, and I think another sibling as well, but also at the same time having showing signs of mental disorder and mental health issues. And there is evidence of a genetic link to schizophrenia that runs in families or even bipolar. Like, a lot of mental health disorders do
have evidence. I blame the eggs. I lost it on the keto diet.
So, I mean, it could be that they share what's called candidate genes, which are sort of genes that are linked to a disorder. And there could be, I mean, there's 230 for schizophrenia, I think. So the multiple genes that could be.
Is it one of those things where they'll have the gene, they'll have a predisposition to it, but it takes something that to trigger it, like extreme heat exhaustion in a foreign country for months?
Yeah, so, like, according to the diathesis stress model.
Yeah.
So if you've got...
So had he not gone on that trip, potentially, he might not have...
It's the stress, or, I mean, if we define stress as sort of a change in events that causes negative effects, which is kind of the proper version. Yeah, it's like this prolonged tiredness could have been his version of stress that resulted in the diagnosis. Yeah, absolutely. So Robert, the father, did not publicly acknowledge that his son was having difficulties. And remember, Richard is a well-known public figure at this point. So people are talking about him.
Yeah, he's the Pope puncher.
Yeah. So he did on the sly take his son to see a doctor, and his son was diagnosed with non compos mentis, which basically means not being of sound mind.
Yeah, that just means he's insane.
Yeah, he's not all there, basically.
That's not a diagnosis. That is literally just Latin for batshit crazy. They've done nothing there. Oh, it appears he's non compos mentis. Like, you say that about anyone.
Yeah, but this is the 1800s. They didn't understand. So Robert wanted to give his son the best chance of recovery. So I think...
If he was a woman, it'd have been hysteria.
Exactly, yeah. So he travelled with Richard. So Robert and Richard, father and son, went back to Cobham in Kent, where they were originally from, to get away from the big city. He wanted to give him some time
back
to relax.
To the fossils, go hold a few.
Exactly.
Let's put them to your ear. What does the fossil sound like? Do some mindfulness activities. Like, what would the fossil taste like if you ever had to do mindfulness?
Yeah. So when they arrived back, it was evening. So this is literally the day they get back. And they had dinner at a local inn and then decided to take a short stroll in the countryside. It's August, so evenings are light. It's still sort of nice evening, sort of moonlit stroll. And as they reached a circle of elm trees, Richard, so the son, suddenly attacked his father by punching him in the head, slashing his neck with a razor, and then stabbed him in the chest with a 5-inch knife.
He had a lot of stuff in his pocket.
So then he started dragging his father's body towards a ravine with probably the intention of pushing him into the body into it, but he didn't. He just left it there. And then flees, travels to Dover and boards a boat for France. I mean, clearly this is not he's delusional. It's mental health. It's not, it's not his fault. This is like, it's not a premeditated, I wanted to murder my father. This is something else. So he reached France.
I mean, his father stuck by him when he came back from his trip and stuff, hasn't he? And moved back to Kent with him. So there's no, from what we know, there's no motive for him to have resented his father or anything. Unless it's the fact that he took him from society.
I mean, because it's so long ago, it's really hard to get a lot of information about it. But he was obsessed with the devil. I think he thought his father was obsessed. His father was possessed with the devil. So it was very much part of his condition. So when he gets to France, he's stopped because he has blood all over him. So
He gets to France, that's the first anyone gave a shit about it.
Dover Ferry, no one gives a shit. But in France, that's when they're like, I'm not going to do that. So when he gets to France, that's when they're like, this is kind of weird. They release him, allow him to change his clothes, and then he boards a train to Paris.
I mean, he could, like, if he'd had blood on him ever since he left England, he could have just been like, I ate a cow. I don't know. Like, it could have been any number of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, nosebleed.
It's tomato soup. You don't know. It's been weeks.
Yeah. I'm sure, like, not everyone's looking.
I'm just a dirty scrubber. You don't know me. You don't know my life.
So he's allowed to change his clothes. I don't know where he gets clothes from, but and then he gets on this train to Paris. And then during that train journey towards Paris, he attacks a fellow passenger. So this passenger's another tourist from England on the way to Paris. He pulled out his razor.
Oh my God, he kept that.
And tried to slash the passenger, but others in the cabin grabbed him, restrained him. Obviously, it's a busy cabin. Someone's going to step in. And then they turn him over to the police. So the police send him back to England. And he is immediately hospitalised back in England at the hospital known as Bethlehem or Bedlam. Bethlehem's the official name, but it was known as Bedlam. The saying, oh my God, it's Bedlam in there, that comes from the hospital. So the hospital came first, and then the saying, oh my God, that is Bedlam, for meaning like it's chaotic, there's uproar, comes from this hospital. So you can imagine the kind of hospital it is. But it is very much a psychiatric hospital. So, they also search Richard's house. They discover his ale and his boiled eggs everywhere. But they also find some pictures of his friends that he's drawn with slashed throats.
I told you it'd just be like shitty pictures of his friends. That'd be the game. You just turn it around like, this is what's going to happen to you.
And then in his pocket, Richard had also had a list of people who must die with his father's name at the top of the list. Clearly he wasn't well. So he remained at Bethlehem Hospital until July 1964.
Maybe he was like touching tombs in Egypt. There's so many stories from the later when people were like going around touching the pharaoh's stuff, getting cursed.
I bet there's a conspiracy theory in there.
Yeah.
So he remained remained at Bethlehem Hospital till 1964, so about 20 years.
Whoa! 1964? Oh, 18.
Oh no, wait, 80. It must be 1864.
That's like he's 150 years old!
1864, it must be, yeah, because in 1864 he moved to Broadmoor. Yeah, so 1864, 20 years. And he painted at hospital and he produced quite a lot of famous paintings.
I bet he did some of those button art.
Yeah.
They love making people in like hospitals do button art.
What, like literally like just pictures, glue buttons?
Gluing buttons to make pictures with.
That's because buttons are round and can't be used to attack anyone.
Yeah.
There's nothing pointy not like about a button.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And then in 1864, he moved to Broadmoor and he did another 22 years there. So he was incarcerated. I mean, I guess hospitalised for 42 years. And then he died of something lung related in 1886. So that is Richard Dadd.
Never Dick Dad. Okay.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Well, this is irritatingly similar.
Oh, shit.
This week's episode is sponsored by Victorian artists fleeing to Paris.
Oh, shit.
Murdering family members.
Oh, shit.
It's pretty much exactly the same story.
What did you type into Google?
So, if you're one of those people that likes to fall asleep to a podcast, like, set the sleep timer now, because you know how it's going to go. So I'm going to tell you about Thomas Griffiths Wainwright. So it is very similar time, but he's a very similar story, but just maybe he was the predecessor to Dick Dad. So he was, it, like, your guy was making the clique in, like, 1840s.
Yeah.
Whereas Thomas Wainwright, he had his own, like, little arty clique in, like, the 1820s.
So he's the original Mean Girls.
He is the original Mean Girls. He's the original dandy. Thomas was the son of Thomas Wainwright Sr. and Anne Griffiths. So his parents had married at the displeasure of Anne's parents, and they'd given birth to their son Thomas in October of 1794. But tragically, Thomas's mother died during the birth, and his father died shortly after.
Oh.
So the orphan baby was taken in by his grandfather, Anne's father, and he was called Dr. Ralph Griffiths. Now, this name carried a lot of weight in the literary and art world at the time, because he was the founder of a magazine called The Monthly Review, which was like the final word in art criticism, like culture criticism. So they moved in very literary circles. He knew a lot of people. The family were in contact with some of the finest minds of the time.
That is quite a cool job for, like, a family member, because you get to... Because it's not like...
Yeah,
not super
because
famous.
Daniel Radcliffe, I watched his Who Do You Think You Are? And I was always like, I remember when they were doing the auditions for the Harry Potter films, because they're like, if you're 11 and you want to be in a Harry Potter film, audition now. But his mum is like a casting agent, and his dad is like a literary critic or some shit. I was like, he knew people.
Yeah,
don't pretend.
Course.
And he always tries to pretend that he wasn't in David Copperfield before he was in Harry Potter as a child. He's like, oh, I just went into film. No, you were in David Copperfield. I saw it. Stop trying to pretend that you didn't already have a film career and you were just a nobody. You were in that film a lot. He was in that film a lot.
We've unearthed some real anger there.
I just always wanted to be Hermione. I was the right age. I had the look. Anyway, right. So Thomas Wainwright has been brought up in this, like, really bohemian, but also still quite aristocratic. Like, it was that nice mix of we're wealthy, but also we're not as restricted. Like,
yeah, we're, like, kind of cool wealthy.
Yeah. And they lived in this fabulous estate, and it was called, the house was called Linden House. This house was pulled down in the mid-19th century, but drawings of the time show it as being like a gorgeous Georgian stately home. It was wonderful. Thomas, similar to old Dick Dad, he was a fairly talented artist himself, and so he was sent to Greenwich Academy. And during his school years, unfortunately, his grandfather also passed away.
Oh, shit.
So he ended up being...
This is like a Graham Young.
Yeah, well, he, again, I don't think he was involved in these deaths, but he was then cared for by his uncle, George Griffiths, who inherited Linden House and lived there. So his lifestyle stayed probably better than it would have been had he been with his parents.
He's lucky he's got so many family members.
Upon leaving school, so his connections to the Linden House and things, they enabled him to continue mixing in artistic circles. He was known to be like a friend of Wordsworth, of William Blake. Like, he knew the people. And he seemed to prefer the lifestyle of an artist, though, to actually producing his own art. He was said to have had an apprenticeship to a painter, and, like, the product of which was he did quite an unflattering portrait of Lord Byron, but who would have actually sat for him. So he knew, like, everyone, but he didn't really love it.
I love how my story's got some names of people that I'm not really sure who they are, and you've got fucking Blake and Words there.
I know, clang on those.
It's like when you go out and you've got a little story about something and you tell it, and then they're like, well, my story. And then they just tell the amped up version of how people. They're so much better than you.
So he ended up leaving his apprenticeship to go and join the guards in the military. But his upbringing had obviously ill prepared him for a strict military life, and he ended up quitting after just 1 year.
I thought you were going to say one day then.
Well, I don't know if he lasted the year, but no doubt there was deafening "I told you so"s from everyone who knew him. So on leaving, he began to try his hand at almost all artistic pursuits, and he did have some minor success as an art journalist. He was a regular contributor to London Magazine in the early 1820s, and his pieces were often published under pseudonyms, which were lovely. One of my favourites was Janus Weathercock. Another good one was Van Vinkrooms.
Vinkrooms.
These are not names. This is just I've written a piece. It's by blah blah floopy bloop. That's basically what he's doing. But his style was well received, and he was very much a darling of the art world. People liked his sort of, he was like a breath of fresh air, because he was just saying it in like a young sort of very much it is what it is kind of way.
Yeah.
There was actually Oscar Wilde, clang, Oscar Wilde wrote a piece about Thomas Wainwright. It's quite a short piece, you can read it, called Pen, Pencil and Poison, A Study in Green. He wrote it about 40 years after Thomas Wainwright died, but he did describe him at the time and what he was like. He was thought to have, his white hands were bespangled with regal rings, and he had the conversation of a smart, lively, heartless, voluptuous coxcomb.
Oh, hello.
He's like a dandy. And Oscar himself actually said, he was determined to startle the town as a dandy, and his beautiful rings, his antique cameo breastpin, and his pale lemon kid gloves. I mean, can you imagine how, like, lemon gloves? Like,
yeah, no.
It's a look. It's a strong look. His rich curly hair, fine eyes, and exquisite white hands gave him the dangerous and delightful distinction of being different from others. I think that's a bit of an Oscar Wilde wink to that one. Yeah. I mean, the white hands are a big deal. I guess because it means you do nothing with your time.
Oh, okay.
And he always wore gloves, so never got any sunlight on those little... White. I mean, it sounds horrific. I think Oscar. Can you imagine just some little clammy, pale,
droopy
fingers?
Cute,
I'm not a fan.
But
that's what people liked about him. He was very vain, very fashionable, but also, yeah. So that was his thing. So he was also known to be quite effeminate, and it said that he would speak in a voice that was no louder than a whisper at all times.
I met a guy like that. I went to this, like, it was like a smoothie shop, but they did, like, it felt like breakfast. It was like a bowl of things that would normally be in a smoothie, but not quite liquidized.
Yeah.
With some oats. But
deconstructed smoothie.
The guy was literally, like, whispering. He's like, and would you like that dairy or non-dairy? And we were like, what? Like, this is not the job for you. He's so quiet, but so sweet with it.
I can just imagine this art critic that he'll be, like, putting his little dainty white hands on you and be like, darling. The latest Titian. I don't know when Titian was. It's probably all done by then. Anyway, so he also exhibited some of his own work at the Royal Academy. But despite the relative praise and success that he received, Thomas Wainwright was not able to manage his finances so well. When his granddad had died, he'd put some money in trust for him, and he was given an allowance each year of £200. But this wasn't equal to the lavish lifestyle and expensive tastes that he had become accustomed to. So in 1821, Wainwright had married a woman called Eliza Frances Ward, but she wasn't bringing any real money of her own to the partnership, so now he had to support her as well, and the finances were becoming more and more of an issue. So by 1926, Wainwright forged the signatures of the trustees who were holding the inheritance from his grandfather, which enabled him to take out a £2,000 loan against this money. I think he had to forge several signatures. But such drastic measures still didn't solve his money worries, because this was used to either pay off existing debts or he spent it on maintaining his image of wealth in society. And it was just a short-term solution to what was a growing problem. He was just getting further and further in trouble. So in a couple of years later, 1928, Wainwright was desperate enough to swallow his pride, and he asked his Uncle George if he and his wife would be permitted to come and live with him back at Linden House. So his uncle had brought him up for the majority of his life and agreed to help him out in his hour of need. Now, this obviously could have been a great opportunity for Wainwright to get back on his feet and sort himself out, but then we wouldn't have much of a story. So he continued to spend his allowance on clothes, jewellery, going out, and it wasn't long till he was completely up to his eyeballs in debt again. So, not too many months after they'd begun this whole new living arrangement, Wainwright's Uncle George fell ill. It wasn't obvious what had caused the illness, but after a few painful days, he was dead. Silver lining to this, of course, is that Wainwright then inherited the Linden House and was also given a sum of money that he could go and pay off some debts with. So he's back afloat again. But the couple still needed help. So in 1830, Wainwright asked his mother-in-law, Ellen Abercrombie, to move into Linden House with them. She agreed, and she came with Eliza's two half-sisters, Helen and Madeline. And it's thought that Wainwright began some sort of campaign of persuasion to try and get Eliza's mother to change her will so that she was the main beneficiary.
Yeah,
if
I was going to say, is he a... Because he wouldn't be a beneficiary, but I guess...
Yeah.
She'd be one of three.
Yeah, he was trying to get his wife's name to be like she was going to get the most of it. But Helen was the oldest of the daughters from this other marriage. And because she wasn't married yet, she was still really young. Mrs. Abercrombie could not be persuaded to change the will, which seems fair. Why would you give your married daughter who's living in this home that can provide for all of us the money and not this other other young daughter who's not yet settled?
Yeah.
So that couldn't happen.
But yeah, because she's less likely to get a husband if she's got no money to come to her.
Exactly. But if this caused any unpleasantness or arguments amongst the family, it wasn't going to last long, because in August of that same year that they'd moved in, Mrs. Abercrombie was also struck by a sudden illness that, similarly to Uncle George, proved fatal. This didn't cause any suspicion in itself, because Thomas Wainwright didn't stand to gain anything from her death. But what it did mean was that then Helen now had the money.
Yeah.
And she was able.
And she's still living in their house.
Still living in their house. So Wainwright took like a little chess move, moved the mother out of the way, and then took out an £18,000 life insurance policy on 20-year-old Helen.
Fuck.
That a huge sum. He was going to, like, this is going to be the scam to end all scams.
I still don't understand these life insurance policies that they were just taking out willy-nilly.
Yeah.
Because what's in it for the insurance policy? Is it just that you're paying every month?
Well, exactly. And for Helen, she's so young and so healthy that, yeah, sure, we'll give you 18,000, because he should have been paying that every month for the next 60 years.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't a risk to them. So 10 months, though, after this insurance policy was taken out, Helen was also a victim of the mystery illness that seemed to come upon Linden House.
She was.
So by now, this was suspicious, and the insurance company refused to pay out anything.
Well, I would. Like, that's clearly...
Especially for such a huge amount, he's not paid anything in.
He hasn't insured the other sister. She's the one who died. It's so obvious.
But Wainwright was like, needed it, so he tried to take them to court and force them to pay money on the claim. But by now, more and more people were talking and making assumptions and basically saying, yeah, he's probably poisoned everyone, and it was becoming gossip. So he wasn't entirely stupid. Wainwright could see that the writing was on the wall, and he fled to France.
Oh.
He managed to settle there, actually, for a number of years following his escape. He went to Boulogne, although he didn't manage to keep his nose entirely clean. He spent 6 months in prison in Paris for fraud, and he was suspected of a murder as well. I've got suspected of a few murders. It was all fine. Basically, a gentleman that Wainwright was lodging with suddenly died.
Right, lodging with.
Of course. Wainwright had taken out a life insurance policy on his host worth $3,000. But he was arrested for the suspicion of the murder, and he was even found to have strychnine on his person, which we've talked about before. It was a common substance. It was found in like lots of small doses, was basically a medicine for all sorts. Cleaning products, everything. Very similar to arsenic. It was just used in so much stuff. So he did have it on him. He did have fatal amounts on him, but it can just be argued away as being for so many everyday things.
Yeah.
But historians now assume that it was almost certainly strychnine that he was using. It's colourless, odourless. Put it in food, no one's going to know.
Yeah.
Then, in 1837, so he'd been away for about 6 years, Wainwright decided to try and return to his life in London. Now, some people say that this is possibly because he'd gotten away with this murder, he was felt a bit more confident about it. Oscar Wilde was convinced that it was because he loved a woman. She must have been beautiful for him to risk his life like this. She probably didn't love him back. I think it's pure speculation. There was no evidence of a woman.
Oscar Wilde is loving the drama.
Yeah, he's just like, oh my God, the only reason... Oscar Wilde loved this guy. Like, if you read the essay, it will take you probably about 15 minutes. It's all about how he doesn't blame him. How could, like, he's like saying that basically an artistic person acts for different purposes to other people. He has different values. He's so just too artistic. And he's like, if this was a few centuries earlier, before the moral police, these artistic passions wouldn't have even been punished. Like, he's... loves him.
But he's got nothing. I mean, it's his version of Bloody Love Island, isn't it? Like, it comes with loads of drama and gossip. Brilliant. Hours of evening conversations filled.
And so he wasn't. So when he returned to England, obviously there was still all this suspicion about the deaths of his family members, but he wasn't charged with the murders. There wasn't much evidence that they could charge him with, but he was widely being known as Wainwright the Poisoner. He couldn't really go anywhere. So he sort of went into hiding a bit. He wasn't out in society, and the police were trying to pin him for something. So eventually they decided to charge him with counts of fraud. In particular, he was arrested and charged with the fraud from 1826, where he'd forged the trustee's signatures on his grandfather's money. I'll go back to Oscar Wilde. He tells, in his version, said that he was holed up in a room with the curtains closed, and when he'd heard some noises in the street, he'd gone... It was because of, quote, his artistic interest in modern life that led him to open the curtains and accidentally reveal himself to people. So basically, because he was a nosy ass, he fucking opened the curtains to see, oh, what's going on here? And someone spotted him and said, oh, that's Wainwright the Poisoner. But for Wilde, he just had such an artistic interest in other people. How could he not open the curtains?
Yeah.
Crazy. He had various charges of fraud then, and he was going to... Some of them carried a capital charge. So originally he had pled not guilty, and then he decided if he pled guilty to the fraud charges that didn't carry a capital sentence, then he might have more chance of just being given a lighter sentence and not being killed. So he pleaded guilty at the Old Bailey on the 6th of July, 1837, and he was sentenced to transportation for life. I'm sure people know about transportation, that he would be sent off to Australia, that sort of area. He was sent to what was called Van Diemen's Land, which is now Tasmania. And Oscar says, to a man of his culture, this was a form of death. was basically a death sentence for him, having to put up with these peasants. So he arrived there in November of 1837, and he was forced to seek employment as a labourer. Can you imagine these little lemon gloves and his pasty hands? But he did still continue to dabble in art, and he has some of his commissioned portraits still surviving in collections today. But he died of an apoplexy on August 17th, 1847, at age 53. Some other little bits from his story was, it's said that while he was being remanded before being sent to Tasmania, Charles Dickens went on a visit of the prison just to like have a little look around. And he saw Thomas Wainwright and spoke to him, and that inspired him to write basically this one of his little novelettes called Hunted Down, which isn't one that I'm particularly familiar with, but it's basically this story of Thomas Wainwright. Also, one of the more famous things that people, when they hear a little bit of this story, is that apparently in this visit, they were chatting to him about what he'd been up to, and someone asked him outright, what about Helen? Did you kill her? And apparently, according to legend and Oscar Wilde, he responded that he had, but she had very thick ankles, as if like that was the reason why he'd killed her. But then now people are saying that that was probably just made up by the publisher to try and sell Oscar Wilde's, you know, his outrageous writings.
Yeah.
But do you know what? I might believe that he did, knowing like how much of a dandy he was, like maybe as a joke, like, oh yes, but darling, her clothes were a crime against fashion.
I've got thick ankles and it's not cute. I was trying to take a photo of my Birkenstocks for Instagram. I was like, oh god, I look like a 90-year-old woman.
Birkenstocks don't make your ankles look any better,
no,
though.
No, they are not flattering. Well, that fucked my story in the ass.
I don't know that it did.
It's got a lot more...
It's the same story. Let's kill people and run away to France.
That's true.
Let's do paintings and then kill people and run to France. You also had, like, obsessed with the devil and he tried to attack the Pope.
That's true. Yeah, he did punch the Pope. Well, try and punch the Pope. So, thanks for listening, guys. Yeah, we're going to be in... Like, we'll be around in a bit, but don't delete our podcast, but it is the summer. So, yeah, if you could keep on tweeting us, though, at SlaughterThePod on Twitter. You can email us, slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, see if you can work out any more about the story I did last week with the postman. I think a few people have been intrigued by that one. We've had a few, like, tweets and things saying, I really want to know more. We're on Instagram, Lucy Emma Slaughter. I'll just post more pictures of food.
Look at her feet and fruit.
Yeah. Thanks for listening and have a good summer, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.